2012 is fast approaching. If you are a local musician or band, now is your chance to get in on this high-stakes Battle of the Bands and earn yourself some prizes and glory. Past participants of Shindig include the Pack AD, 3 Inches of Blood, Japan Droids, You Say Party, and so much more. All styles are welcome. The deadline for digital submission is August 6th, while physical entries must be received by August 12th. For instructions on how to submit your entry, go to CITR.ca or find CITR Radio on Facebook.
Welcome to your Friday edition of News 101. I'm Louise Boyd.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? First up on your Friday edition for August 3rd, we bring you national coverage from Groundwire.
Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire was produced by Carly Forbes, CFRU, in Guelph, Ontario. In this edition, updates on the Musqueam struggle to protect Tsesnam, reflections on the recent ruling to strike down the ban on assisted suicide, and the preservation of the Tsut'inagana language. But first, here's a headline about the racist opportunism in the aftermath of a recent shooting in Scarborough.
I'm Mary Carl Giel in Guelph reporting for Groundwire. Racist political opportunism used surrounding July Scarborough shootings. On Monday the 16th of July is when a backyard party on Danzig Street in Scarborough, Ontario got out of hand. The incident resulted in 2 deaths and over 20 being injured, including a 22-month-old child. The 2 young men who died in the incident were 14-year-old Cheyenne Charles and 23-year-old Joshua Yasse, but investigators believe they were not the intended victims. But despite the horrors witnessed by local communities and their desire to return to normal, Canadian politicians are using the events as a platform to spew anti-immigrant comments and hatred. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, in particular, jumped into the spotlight shortly after the news broke and said, quote unquote, "I don't care if you're an immigrant or not. If you get caught with a gun, I want to find out the legalities of are you allowed to stay here or are you not? I'm sure it falls under some sort of immigration law." Before any charges or arrests had been made, the focus of political commentary was on the role immigrants played in this unfortunate scene. Such events are seen by politicians like Ford as an opportunity to promote anti-immigrant laws and rhetoric. This is now a growing and long-standing trend in Canada, the linking of crime to immigration. Well, certain crimes, that is. Through media interviews and legislation like Bill C-43, the Canadian government is trying hard to associate gun violence with immigration and address the issue by physically removing from the country those they suspect to be involved, most especially if they are immigrants. Mayor Rob Ford also wants social programming to be cut, calling it, quote-unquote, hug-a-thug funding, and declaring that such investments bring few returns. These remarks do little to bridge the gap between City Hall and marginalized people of color and immigrant communities. Ford appears to have little interest in actually resolving disputes. deportation is seen as the easier option and is being touted by him and his colleagues. In a joint public statement from Toronto-based Filipino and Latino community organizations concerning events in the wake of the Danzig Street shootings, Pablo Vivanco of Barrio Nuevo raised this exact point, quote-unquote, "We also need to start asking where these guns are coming from, who is bringing them into this city, and why. These youth are not making or smuggling guns, so we need to acknowledge that there are bigger things at play and target the real players in this morbid game." For people like Prime Minister Stephen Harper and Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, it is easier to point the finger of blame on young people from a marginalized community instead of looking more closely at biker gangs or larger elements within organized crime that actually import these guns into the country. The July 16th bloodshed is what made the news, but arguably the bigger criminals are the ones who profited from the event and continue to evade both charges and public scrutiny. I'm Mary Carl Giao, reporting in Guelph for Groundwire.
Now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report, produced by Shelley Robinson.
Big up yourself wherever you are. It's only about, 19 minutes past 4 o'clock. We go on until 5 o'clock. My name is Douglas Stulen and Michelle right here. Have a Thursday from 3 to 5 o'clock.
So I met Delroy as a volunteer because I started at CHOI as a volunteer. In this space, he is very much jovial and above the rim in terms of happiness. And on one occasion, I took info to the studio during his show. And he sent somebody and said, she needs to come in. And she needs to say that on air. And it started from there. We became friends as well as co-hosts and all that kind of stuff.
Always a friend, always a friend. Folks, don't forget, coming up at 5 o'clock, we get news with the crew. And with us, Lissy, thank you so much for touching base. Well, Lissy, good afternoon, and thank you, Mr. Ramdan's master, father the greatest, of course, inside the studio. Rich Kid International, respect. Thank you for the link in the lady saw. Action, big up yourself. You don't know, you're the champion for life, and life is always with you.
He was definitely one of those individuals in the space that was very welcoming and open. He would be very open to women in the space. And his show was one of the shows where a lot of women got a chance to not just sit in, but also tech. I was a host for his show on many occasions. And other females that have come through the CHOI space can say they started there and then they went on to get their own shows or so on.
Classic reggae rock inside 105.5. 12 minutes past 4 o'clock, you know what I'm saying? Classic Mix Supreme.
His show was a reggae show. It was called Mix Supreme, and the format was really, as the name suggests, a mixture of reggae. But his real interest would have been rockers and vintage reggae. So his show had a lot of lovers rock, a lot of, you know, the Barris Hammonds and the Dennis Browns and the Gregory Isaacs. And then his show was also welcoming to Canadian talent. So there were a number of artists that, as they would say in the reggae scene, that bus on his show.
I want to say to the massive, don't forget about the Reggae Music Achievement Award taking place June the 10th at Club Paradise featuring Lady Jade, Anthony Malva, special guest Steel, the Mystic, Juno Jazz, and also the brother man called Mr. Keith Poppin that give you same thing for breakfast, same thing for dinner. That's June the 10th at Club Paradise, the Reggae Music Achievement Awards.
For Delroy, I think what he wanted was just to have a space where he could unwind, have fun, and make those connections with people. And there are a number of people who, through his loss, we've seen come to the hospital to visit or come to visitations and so on. And they're all a lot of listeners. And they just had this kind of connection to him. And so as an ambassador for CHRY, he definitely had that connection to people and connection to community.
I just want to remind us of a great radio man who passed away.
Yes.
And, yeah. I'm going to miss him.
Yeah, definitely.
Mr. Sterling.
Mr. Sterling. Yeah, man, trust me.
You know, it's important, like I said, you know, to have a voice. He made a difference.
Yes.
Big things.
CHRY got together, and they put on an amazing tribute Memorial. With the Mountain Edge Band and EOP Band, yeah, Tanya Mullins, Steel, Tony Anthony. There were so many artists that came out. Luther Brown, with pride, said the doors have been closed. Mm-hmm. They've maxed the capacity in JCA, which we've never seen done before. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Delroy was an amazing man.
We're going to miss him, you know. Zoom gone, but it's not forgotten, you know.
All right, most definitely.
Yeah.
He really was electrifying in the space. Always dancing during his show, you know, he was having fun with the music because he really, really loved the music. Just having that avenue, I think, in retrospect, he would have said he got a lot.
In our first feature, Gennarji O'Sullivan and Woody Morrison spoke with Cecilia Point, a spokesperson for the Musqueam people currently protecting their ancestors' ancient burial site from being developed into condos.
And now we have our friend, her name is Cecilia Point. She's the spokesperson for the Musqueam Midden. It's based at the foot of Marpole, and it's based at the foot of the Arthur Lang Bridge. There has been a protest site there for over 60 days. A lot of things have happened. They've been trying to negotiate with the province. The city is on their side, as well as the developer, and doing a sort of like a land swap deal. But the province was unable to make a decision. They brought in a negotiator. The negotiator, they couldn't come up with anything on their own. So now they're dealing at a different level with the owner. So Cecilia is here to give us the update. Hello, Cecilia.
Hi, Gennarji. How are you?
I'm good. We got a full house. Everybody that is in the studio are major supporters of the Musqueam protest.
That's fantastic. And I also wanted to introduce you to Rhiannon Bennett, another Musqueam member. She's here with me. And whenever you can't reach me, Rhiannon will also do media inquiries.
Good afternoon.
Hi there. How are you?
Doing well, thank you.
Nice to hear from you. So the both of you are involved in this new phase of negotiations?
Yes, yeah.
So
we're not at the negotiating table, but we're here at the protest site, you know, and we're keeping watch of the construction site.
And how has that been going so far?
The latest update is that we are now in direct negotiations with Century Group, and I guess the new company is called Century Holdings, and so they're a combination of the Hackett family's business, LandPro, and Century Group. So they formed this company that now owns the property. So the band is negotiating directly with them to purchase this property.
I understand that the construction companies, everybody was there, packed up their tools and went home.
Well, not all of them. They packed up some of their equipment and taken some things out of the office here. They moved their first aid trailer away and so on.
And also the owner, Mr. Hackett, he has a daughter who has been coming around the site and acting up a storm over there. Tell us more about that.
Well, she came one day last week, and as you know, we have a legally appointed monitor who is allowed to be on the site. So, like I said, the construction crew was coming and picking up some items. So our monitor was on the site making sure that, you know, they're not removing boxes that have our ancestors' bones in them and artifacts and so on. So our monitor was there. And the young lady came, and I guess she gave them an envelope. I don't know what for, but she had to have some interaction with the construction crew or the movers. And she kicked our monitor off of the site and told him he's not allowed to be on there. And I told her, you know, that yes, someone can come from the band office right now with a letter telling you that we are allowed to have a monitor outside the site. And she yelled at us and said we were only allowed outside the fence and that she was going to call the police. I said to her, please call the police and we will show them this letter and, you know, indicating that we're allowed to have one monitor inside the fence. But she just kept yelling at us. And there was a gentleman with her who I've since learned is her business partner. And he yelled at us, you know, that this is private property and we're not allowed on it. And he actually even yelled at us, why didn't you do something about this 52 years ago? It was also upsetting that they decided to come on the day that Wayne's mother's funeral was taking place.
That's right. Rose Point just passed away a while ago, and as a result, the people at the Musqueam site all came to be in support of the family. Most of the people from the site went there, so at that point, you were vulnerable, and that is when the owner decided to make his little moves on the site, right?
Right, and the last day they came before that was Aboriginal Day, where, again, all the community was up at our band, you know.
Well, Cecilia, I'd just like to point out that that isn't uncommon. It's people that were building the Enbridge pipeline and proposed to build it on the Wet'suwet'en territory. The Wet'suwet'en people had somewhat, like, they had the same problem. One of the elders from their community passed away. They were at the services, and while they were at the service, Enbridge was trying to lay down the pipeline and the equipment to start drilling. And so one of the young people from that territory had to leave the service and set up a blockade, and that's how that all started, you know. And then there was this division caused from the people who were treaty and anti-treaty and all of that. So it's not an unknown tactic, just as earlier when Woody was saying that they take our children away to make us more vulnerable and do whatever it is that they want us to do.
And now it's time for a short musical break.
Sight of naked fear choked every limb. Young man, what is your name? Young man, what is your name? The human heart will refrain, it is all the same.
Specs, who performed at Hillside Festival in Guelph recently. Now for an interview with Bruce Starlight about the preservation of the Tsut Inhagana language.
That's Bruce Starlight, the director of the Tsut Inhagana Institute. The institute is dedicated to the study and preservation of the Tsut Ina language. It's located on the Tsut Ina Reserve on the southwest edge of the city of Calgary. The language is recognized as being one of the most critically endangered in the country, with just 51 fluent speakers who are all elders. Here's a little more from Bruce.
We've been doing language since 1972, and we really haven't made any progress. And I think if you went to most of the communities, they'll tell you the same thing. We haven't produced speakers right across Canada. If they have, they've been very lucky and they have a very unique approach. And that's what we're trying to create here. And a lot of other communities can, you know, where they have a large speaker base, they can go to immersion. But we don't have that luxury because the youngest speaker is 64 years old. So we're an extinct language according to the rules of the linguistic community. So we are in a crisis situation with our languages, and we need to begin to talk to one another.
Starlight, who grew up speaking the Sutina language within his family, believes that it is important to understand fundamental differences between Aboriginal languages like Sutina and colonial languages like English.
I'm not a teacher. My background is linguistics. But, you know, I see the problem all over. You know, there's no retention. There's no, there's words. In this community, maybe there's 1,000 words out there. But, you know, the language is made up of about 10 million words. And it's very unlike English. English has, it's finite. But our languages continue to grow. They continue to change. Because that's who we are. That's the resilience of our people as First Nations. We're always, how you say, we're always in flux. We're always ready to change. And so that's the nature of our languages, that it changes and it accepts and it creates the, how you say, the room to accept other foreign influences, not so much the language. Our language, we've been among the Blackfoot for 400 years. We've been with a white man for 200 years. We haven't bought any words. One of the comments I just heard recently was that I am a speaker. I'm immersed in the language. I was inundated. I was immersed in the language. He said, today, he said, these people that are learning my language, they know it, but they don't know about it, and they didn't live the language.
The Sutina Gunaha Institute is planning a language conference for spring of 2013, and Bruce Starlight hopes to work with members of other First Nations to find strategies to better teach Aboriginal languages in communities with few fluent speakers, like Sutina, where most kids hear only English at home.
This old lady told me, "Dikana sahiste." That's what she said. That means, don't be writing it down. Our languages are holy. And then, you know, and that was before I went back to school. And then when I went back to university, I began to see what this old lady was saying. What I realized was the ability to change. It's not there because you wrote it down. You look at English, you look at French, you look at German. That's it. What is written is it. Because the white man and our children, that's what they know. Because for all intents and purposes, we've become white. You know, and because everything, you know, our dress, our demeanor, our anger, it's all foreign to us. When I was growing up, it wasn't like that.
Although he's been working on this for a long time, Starlight believes that the pieces needed are there.
See, our scholars died off during the epidemics. All our astronomers, all our scientists died. And we had nothing. That's why it appeared to the white men we had nothing. But we lost it. Through our scientists. And there is a lot of knowledge yet among our people, but it's just coming back. You know, it's coming back in bits and pieces, but if you gather all what's remaining from all Aboriginal people, you'll find that the whole story of the universe has some here, some there, some there.
This is Catherine Fisher from Kootenai Co-op Radio, reporting for Groundwire.
And now, a feature from AMI Audio's interview program, Contact, regarding a historic court decision on a controversial issue. Jason Vermesh of AMI Audio reports.
On June 15th, this country's ban on assisted suicide was struck down by the BC Supreme Court. Madam Justice Lynn Smith ruled the criminal code provisions, quote, unjustifiably infringe the equality rights of people with disabilities. The ruling affects Gloria Taylor, who suffers from ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, as well as two other plaintiffs, Lee Carter and her husband Hollis Johnson. Carter and Johnson joined the landmark legal challenge on behalf of Lee's elderly mother, Kay Carter, whom they helped obtain a legal assisted suicide in Switzerland. Nearly two decades ago, the Supreme Court of Canada ruled against medically assisted suicide. Yet, this kind of procedure is permitted in Switzerland, Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and the state of Oregon. Justice Smith allowed the BC decision to be suspended for 1 year, allowing Parliament to respond. Earlier this month, the federal government announced it would appeal the BC court ruling. This issue has raised the concerns of certain groups like the Council of Canadians with Disabilities and Euthanasia Prevention Coalition, who have stated the lives of people with disabilities are more vulnerable as a result of this decision. Amy Hasbrook of the disability organization Not Dead Yet says she believes the decision is actually discriminatory.
It is simply not illegal to kill oneself, but there is no right to take one's life. And in fact, we have a public policy against suicide. We spend an awful lot of money to try to prevent people from killing themselves. If someone says that they want to kill themselves, they could be incarcerated in a psychiatric hospital against their will for fear that they might hurt themselves. The problem is that when these standards are applied disparately in a uneven manner. So if a person with a disability says, or I should say if a person without a disability says, I feel really miserable, my life is terrible, I want to end it all, that person is given suicide prevention treatment, steered toward mental health counseling, potentially even incarcerated to prevent him or her from killing himself. On the other hand, if a person with a disability says the same thing, my life is miserable, I don't want to go on anymore, that person is encouraged to kill him or herself. And in addition, it's not just that that person is encouraged, but the person is assisted. In general, the statistics on suicide are that approximately 90% of suicide attempts fail because, as we know, that they're often a cry for help. Well, the same thing can be true for people with disabilities. But if we have the state stepping in and saying this person's suicide should succeed, then we have a person, a doctor, coming in and making that suicide attempt succeed, whereas the suicide attempt of a non-disabled person might not. So that's a double standard that we feel is very inappropriate and discriminatory. But we're saying that the double standard that's applied to the suicides of people with disabilities is the discriminatory problem.
Grace Pastine, litigation director with the BC Civil Liberties Association, who is involved in bringing the case to the BC Supreme Court, disagrees.
This is one thing that really changed between when Sue Rodriguez brought her case before the Supreme Court of Canada and when Gloria Taylor brought her case before the court. In those intervening 20 years, a number of jurisdictions began to allow for medically assisted dying for the terminally ill or for the seriously and incurably ill. And a lot of research was done on those jurisdictions. Oregon's Death with Dignity legislation has been called the most studied piece of legislation in the world. It's been very closely studied by very prominent scholars. Some of these scholars and researchers gave evidence before Madam Justice Smith. What this research shows is that fears about medically assisted dying are unfounded. I mean, certainly it is extremely important that there be safeguards in place. But once those safeguards are in place,
what the evidence shows is that medically assisted dying upholds choice, it prevents suffering, it upholds human rights.
Pastine expects the matter to be ultimately decided by the Supreme Court of Canada. To hear these interviews in their entirety, please visit AMI at ami.ca and follow the contact link on the homepage. This is Jason Vermesh of AMI Audio reporting to Groundwire.
That's it for this week's edition of Groundwire. Music this week was by Cold Specs from Etobicoke, Ontario. Thank you to Gennargio Sullivan, Woody Morrison, Mary Carl Giao, Catherine Fisher, Paul Daniel, Jason Vermesh, and Leanne Arneson. Groundwire is a project of the NCRA.
You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. I'm Claire Eagle, and we're going to take a quick break, but please do stay with us for more news.
Interested in NGOs or the nonprofit sector? Want to teach in another country? How about a position in the commerce or engineering sector? Do you want to travel abroad and have a life-changing experience? Isaac UBC offers different internships for all kinds of specialties. We are looking for students interested in fields such as the HIV/AIDS pandemic, community empowerment, business administration, education, environment, and sustainability, and much more. If you're interested in working abroad or helping out on campus, please contact ubc.aiesec@gmail.com. That's ubc.aiesec@gmail.com. It's up to you.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC Westside area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Grill, Gumdrops, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca. Know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
Welcome back to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. My name is Claire Eagle, and it's now time for more international news from Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 3rd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, deadly attacks continue in Syria as the UN condemns the violence but stops short of calling on President Assad to step down.
The conflict in Syria is a test of everything this organization stands for. I do not want today's United Nations to fail that test.
The federal government releases new guidelines on deportation relief, but many undocumented youth are skeptical. And we'll go to Israel, where members of the ultra-Orthodox community are protesting an impending military draft. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Three protesters who allegedly broke into a nuclear facility in East Tennessee are pleading not guilty to federal charges of trespassing. For FSRN, Brandon Hollingsworth has more from Knoxville.
82-year-old Sister Megan Rice of Las Vegas, Michael Wally of Washington, D.C., and Greg Burgie Obed of Duluth, Minnesota, are accused of trespassing on the highly sensitive Y-12 campus. The facility in Oak Ridge maintains and stores weapons-grade nuclear materials. Last Saturday, the trio allegedly cut through a fence and evaded security measures to spray paint slogans and spill blood on a building housing the nuclear materials. Ralph Hutchison of the Oak Ridge Environmental Peace Alliance says the three protesters carried an anti-nuclear weapons message.
They wanted to call attention to the fact that nuclear weapons of mass destruction are produced at Y-12. In particular, they wanted to call attention to the fact that the government plans to spend $7.5 billion on the uranium processing facility, which will be a new bomb plant in Oak Ridge.
Y-12 is idle today, 2 days after the government contractor at the site halted operations. Thousands of Y-12 workers are undergoing refresher courses in security as officials try to determine how Rice, Wally, and Burgie Obed breached the area. Brandon Hollingsworth, FSRN, Knoxville.
In Pennsylvania, lawyers have wrapped up closing arguments in the state's controversial voter ID law hearing. Pennsylvania is a presidential swing state, and the law could affect which candidate voters choose in the general election. From Philadelphia, FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett signed the voter ID law in March. But the case by the ACLU of Pennsylvania, which wrapped up Thursday, could have the law overturned before it's ever even implemented. Lawyers based their defense heavily on a U.S. Supreme Court decision out of Indiana, while the ACLU's lawsuit was filed under Pennsylvania's state constitution. The state also couldn't pin down the number of people who do not have IDs, had no written plan to provide IDs, and
they really didn't have any witnesses.
Vic Wozniak is the legal director for the ACLU of Pennsylvania.
The entire reason for this law was to prevent impersonation voter fraud at the polls, and the Commonwealth had admitted that they had no evidence of any impersonation fraud taking place. And they also admitted that even if the court blocked the voter ID law, there was not a danger of impersonation voter fraud in November. So there really is no cause for this law.
Both sides indicated they would appeal a loss. Wozniak says he expects the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to have a decision before the election in November. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
London police arrested a group of feminists from Ukraine who were protesting the International Olympic Committee for including Islamic countries with Sharia law in the Games. They argue that women do not have equal rights in these countries and should be excluded. Video from AFP shows a small group of topless women from the Femin organization being arrested in a public square. Femin is known for their provocative protests, including the regular use of nudity. This is the first year Saudi Arabia has included women on its Olympic team. The first, Wojan Shahirkani, quickly lost in her opening judo match today, wearing a black cap to cover her head. The other Saudi woman, Sarah Adar, will run in the women's 800 meters on Wednesday. She is expected to wear long pants and shirt, along with a head covering. Members of Western Canada's First Nations bands will gather for a healing walk tomorrow near the vast ongoing tar sands oil development in northeastern Alberta. A contingent from the Northwest U.S. is joining the walk in solidarity. FSRN's Lee Robartes has this preview.
Opponents of the Canadian tar sands project near Fort McMurray in northeastern Alberta say it is the largest industrial project on Earth. Tar sands development is expected to eventually cover an area the size of the state of Florida. Jesse Cardinal is an organizer with the Keepers of the Athabasca, a group named for the river and vast watershed that includes boreal forests and peatlands. Cardinal says an elder in her band, who collects medicinal plants in the tar sands area, told her their old cultural ways are disappearing due to the pollution.
Our medicines are disappearing, she said, and what they're doing when they dig up the ground and they're doing all these things underground is they're digging up old sicknesses that have been buried with people and things like that. So that's one of the beliefs of the elders, and definitely that the medicines are disappearing.
Cardinal says she expects the hundreds of Indigenous people who come to the healing walk to witness the type of destruction that could come to other communities. Many of them have already vowed to fight the planned Enbridge Northern Gateway pipelines, which would cross numerous First Nations lands while bringing tar sands oil to the coast. Lee Robartes, FSRN, Idaho.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The UN's General Assembly adopted a resolution today condemning the violence in Syria and calling on the regime of Bashar al-Assad to take steps to end the attacks. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the conflict a test for the international community.
I want us all to show the people of Syria and the world that we have learned the lessons of Srebrenica. United international pressure can make a difference. The Syrian people need action. Their aspirations have been denied. Their suffering is profound, and increasing militarization promises only worse.
The resolution was adopted with a vote of 133 in favor, 12 against, and 31 abstaining. Along with Syria, also opposed was Russia, China, and Cuba. Speaking through an interpreter, Pedro Nunez Mosquera of the Cuban mission to the UN called on outside countries to end their support for the opposition.
We must have a cessation of the transfer of weapons and money to the insurgency groups as well as their training, which without any concealment have become a daily practice of the government of the United States and its European allies in order to defeat by force sovereign governments.
The resolution is non-binding and was only adopted after key provisions such as calling for Assad to step down and countries to impose sanctions on his regime were removed. In Syria, clashes continued and people took to the streets in protests in major cities. According to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, several towns and villages in Daraa held rallies even as most neighborhoods had heavy security presence and snipers could be seen on rooftops. A video posted online today by activists appeared to show large crowds chanting and waving the rebel flag in Aleppo, where violent clashes continue. Near to the capital city of Damascus, reports of killings of civilians in suburbs and attacks on the Yarmouk Palestinian refugee camp, where many residents fled the violence, are emerging. For more, we're joined by Rafif Jojate, spokesperson for the Local Coordination Committees of Syria, a coalition of activist groups in the country. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
You're reporting news today of killings that took place in Damascus. What's the latest on that?
There were multiple massacres in areas in Damascus and in the surrounding countryside. And what we're seeing now is reports of the regime's forces actually setting fire to dead bodies. We've got a death toll around the country of more than 105 in the last hour.
Now you say setting fire to bodies, that was seen in other places like in the massacre in Houla. The speculation then was to make it hard to identify or disrupt evidence. Is there information on that?
Well, it's the regime employs the tactic to accomplish a couple of things. One, it prevents us from being able to document the names or identify the people who have been killed. And from another perspective, it also instills even more fear into the civilian population.
And what part of Damascus was this again, and who were the victims?
We've got reports that the area in Damascus was Jdeidet Artuz, and we've been listing names of people, that some were entire families. There was a particular family that was the mother, the father, and two children. So multiple families, multiple civilians, obviously, burned, some of them burned beyond recognition.
Now, in condemning the UN resolution on Syria today, Syria's ambassador said that arming of rebels from outside and possible crimes carried out by opposition forces are not being taken into account. That was also echoed by Venezuela during the debate. What about violence from rebel fighters or those associated with the opposition? Have you seen any evidence of that?
We've seen reports, and of course there was the filming of the Barry execution in Aleppo yesterday. Many opposition groups have come out and condemned the executions. What we're looking for is rule of law and justice. Our whole revolution is about freedom and dignity and human rights. And so we, as the opposition, need to comport ourselves within those principles and not engage in the types of atrocities the regime is guilty of committing.
Rafif Jojate, spokesperson for the local coordination committees, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Department of Homeland Security has announced new details for temporarily protecting undocumented youth from deportation. Those who meet the government's criteria can apply for a two-year reprieve under a process called deferred action. But immigrant rights activists say they're skeptical of the policy's promises after a campaign to infiltrate a private immigrant detention center finds many DREAM Act eligible youth and other low priority individuals are still being detained and deported. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The new deferred action policy announced by the Obama administration in June promises undocumented youth 2 years of protection from deportation, which can be renewed an unlimited number of times, though it provides neither amnesty nor a path to citizenship. In a conference call Friday, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Representative Alejandro Mayorkas said qualifying individuals can also apply for a work permit if they pay a non-waivable $465 fee. He declined to say how long the review process could take. Calling the move a reason to celebrate, Illinois Democrat Luis Gutierrez addressed so-called Dreamers Thursday on the path opening up to them.
You've gone before the government. You've given them your fingerprints. You've shown you qualified for the president's action, and you got that deferral. Well, the next time immigration stops you, you have the deferral. They'll let you go, like any other person that is legally in the United States working and living.
In order to qualify, individuals must be between 16 and 30 years old, have no criminal record, and be able to prove at least 5 years of continuous residency in the U.S. They can either be currently enrolled in school, have a high school diploma or GED, or be an honorably discharged veteran of the military or Coast Guard. According to the Pew Hispanic Center, more than a million people could benefit. Gutierrez urged the nation's undocumented youth to voluntarily come forward and reveal their status to the government.
On August 15th, show America who you are and remind America that freedom and equality is for all of us.
But some immigrant rights activists say they're skeptical of the administration's promises, pointing to past announcements from Homeland Security that have not stopped the agency from detaining and deporting non-criminal undocumented youth. Building on the civil disobedience actions leading up to the president's announcement, a group of undocumented young men and women recently put themselves in immigration detention to test the Obama administration's promises. One of them is Marco Saavedra, a college graduate and activist with the National Immigrant Youth Alliance.
I'm calling from Broward Transitional Center on my fifth day of my hunger strike to call attention to all the injustices that exist in the center. I got here because I turned myself into Border Patrol.
Saavedra spoke to FSRN by phone from the Florida prison where he's been held since early July. While incarcerated, he says he's met DREAM Act eligible students, asylum seekers, parents of U.S. citizen children, sexual assault survivors eligible for a U visa, and many other individuals considered low priorities under the administration's guidelines to pursue serious criminal offenders.
This is a low security facility where 600 men come that by and large qualify for prosecutorial discretion on their cases. A lot of the folks don't have any severe criminal cases that would take their request for relief. The cases are just adding up.
The Broward Detention Center is run by GEO Group, a massive multinational corporation that changed its name from Wackenhut in 2003 after decades of lawsuits over sexual assault, corruption, and neglect in its prisons. The hunger strike at GEO's Broward facility comes as an Associated Press report published Thursday finds the nation's private prison company is donating millions to politicians and lobbying the government for policies favorable to their bottom line. GEO spent more than $120,000 this year alone lobbying for the Homeland Security Appropriations Act, which sets immigrant detention policy, while its super PAC gave more than $170,000 in 2012, mostly to Republican candidates. Immigration and Customs Enforcement told the AP that GEO and other corporations who run immigrant detention centers get $166 taxpayer dollars per day per inmate.
I think folks are cognizant even more now that there's profit being made out of folks being detained.
This weekend, Saavedra and the other hunger-stricken activists are organizing protests, demanding better medical care and nutrition standards in the prison, as well as the release of all low-priority inmates. Alice Olstein, FSRN.
In Tanzania, a land development project backed by a U.S.-based company could displace more than 160,000 local residents and threaten forest and wetlands in the region. That's according to a report by the Oakland Institute, which has been tracking the Iowa-based Agrisol Energy and its plans to lease more than 800,000 acres. Agrisol has pledged to improve the local infrastructure and provide jobs, but the Oakland Institute says those pledges have not been carried out. For more, we're joined by Anuradha Mittal, Executive Director of the Oakland Institute. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the land and the people affected by this deal. Agrisol Energy describes these areas as abandoned refugee camps. Are they abandoned? What is the area like?
Well, when Agrisol was talking to investors and speaking to people in the United States trying to raise capital for their project in Tanzania, the site was described as abandoned refugee camp. Due diligence done by the Oakland Institute and our research revealed a very different scenario. The site, which is called abandoned refugee camps, is actually home to over 160,000 people. These people came from Burundi over 40 years ago, true, as refugees. However, in 40 years, if you and I think that these are refugee camps, plastic tarps and stuff, what our research revealed is these are thriving communities with homes and businesses, people who are farmers, who are doing other businesses, who are paying taxes and contributing to the economy. And majority of them have actually been born in Tanzania. So it was anything but an abandoned refugee camp, a picture that was painted by Agrisol Energy, claiming that they were putting these unused lands to good productive use.
And as you say, some 160,000 people, some of them, as your report points out, have been naturalized to stay in Tanzania, is that right?
Well, that is the interesting part of the story. On one hand, Tanzania has been very, very generous and welcomed refugees from Burundi as it has from other places in the past. And in 2008, it was announced that the refugees would be naturalized and would be gaining citizenship. What people do not realize then is that at the same time, in 2007-2008, Agrisol Energy was in conversations with the government of Tanzania, and this naturalization and moving on to citizenship was dependent on these refugees agreeing to relocate, agreeing to destroy their own homes and move to places selected by the government as to where they would be moved. So this whole scheme, which was so praised all around the world, was based on people destroying their homes and businesses and moving. All in return they would get is $200.
So this naturalization process, as you're saying, connected to relocation plan. What about those relocation plans? How does it affect people? Have they been taking place? And what are those plans? What do they highlight?
These people are still waiting for the citizenship papers. As I said, those papers are dependent on them agreeing to move. In the meanwhile, our fieldwork that was conducted by OI researchers in March and April revealed that people have no clear idea about their relocation plans. They have not been given accurate information in terms of compensation that they will receive. Some people believe that they would be given, each person in the family would get $200. Some believe that the whole family will get $200. In the meanwhile, these people have been told that they cannot build homes, they cannot build businesses, they cannot plant crops such as cassava or perennial trees, basically creating a situation that they would be forced to move from that land and then the investor can move in, plans which we had stalled by exposing the deal last June.
We've spoken of the people and the communities there, these communities that have been there for decades and how they would be affected by a project like this. What about the land? At least part of it is a protected area, a forest reserve. What's the environmental impact of this project?
Well, you know, that was a big shock, shocking finding for us during the course of our fieldwork. What we realized that the site which is planned for Agrisol development is actually, some of it is a protected forest reserve. So it has, it is basically a very environmentally fragile area, which has a lot of environmental issues in terms of contribution to the Tanzanian society. In fact, what we find in the feasibility study of AgriSol is that they know that it is a protected area, and in fact, they suggest that perhaps they should change the classification of the system so they can continue and go forward with the so-called development plans, which are based on putting this country, Tanzania, on a treadmill of chemical-based agriculture.
Anuradha Mittal is Executive Director with the Oakland Institute. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Doreen.
For more than 60 years, Israel has required nearly all citizens over 18 to enlist in its military. There has been a long-standing exemption for religious students, but that expired this week after the highest court struck the law down as unconstitutional earlier this year. With the country's parliament in recess until fall, members of the ultra-Orthodox community are now left wondering if they'll be forced into the military. FSRN's Gillian Kessler-Damore has more from Jerusalem.
Over the past month, thousands of Jerusalem's ultra-Orthodox men, women, and children have protested the Israeli government's military draft of members of their community. They have been exempt from military service for the past 10 years, thanks to a provision called the Tal Law. But the Tal Law has been struck down by the courts, and politicians have yet to find a suitable replacement. During a cabinet meeting in April, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he had committed to replacing the Tal Law even before the Supreme Court's ruling.
I had publicly declared that we would replace the Tal law with a new law so that there will be a more equal, just, and fair balance for the state of Israel and all its citizens, Arabs and Jews as one. We will do it. We will do it in a responsible manner that will not incite one part of the public against another part.
But replacing the Tal law has proven more difficult than expected and has caused major ripples in Israeli politics. Shaul Mofaz, head of Israel's center-right Kadima party, pulled out of Netanyahu's coalition government in July over the issue. The latest government proposal calls for 6,000 ultra-Orthodox men to enlist in the army by 2016. The ultra-Orthodox, or Haredi Jewish community, makes up approximately 10% of the Israeli population. Most ultra-Orthodox men do not work and instead spend most of their time studying Torah, Jewish law. The Israeli government subsidizes the community, which has a poverty rate of 60%. This governmental support has caused tensions between secular and religious Jews in Israel. In early July, thousands of Israelis took to the streets of Tel Aviv, demanding that all segments of the Israeli population, quote, shoulder the burden of military service. Jonathan Rosenblum is a member of the ultra-Orthodox community in Jerusalem and director of Jewish Media Resources, an organization that specializes in Haredi issues. He told FSRN that the community's major concerns are that a universal draft will threaten the religious existence of young ultra-Orthodox men and won't allow them to maintain their full-time Torah studies.
That's not a far-fetched fear, because from the time of Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister, Ben-Gurion always said that the army was meant to be an institution of socialization to a common Israeli culture. Haredim simply do not want to be part of the common Israeli culture. They're perfectly prepared to be much more integrated into the economic sphere, much more integrated even into the army, I think. That's going to be a slower process. But they do not want to be part of a larger Israeli culture, which in many respects is antithetical to their values.
The Israeli government has also said it wants to mandate national service for the approximately 1.6 million Palestinian citizens of the state, another part of the population exempt from military service. The latest government plan is to recruit 5,000 Palestinian youth into the program by 2016. Palestinian youth can fulfill national service by volunteering in schools, hospitals, police forces, and other public institutions throughout the country, rather than the military. But in mid-July, at least 400 Arab youth, Palestinian, Bedouin, and Druze citizens of Israel gathered in Nazareth to voice their opposition to being forced into the National Service Program. Nadim Nashif is the director of Beledna, a Palestinian youth organization based in Haifa. He said that Palestinian youth are opposed to national service because it conditions their basic rights on whether or not they serve the state.
And we can take the example of the Druze. Since 1956, the vast majority of young males are serving in the army. They are not getting their rights, no equal rights. In many situations and aspects, they are even Their situation is worse than the rest of the Arabs. So this is a very solid proof that it's not about if you're being if you're serving or not. It's about if you're Jewish or not. I think that our word should be very clear and loud, saying that our rights are natural. Our rights are not conditioned by this politician or that or this or other politician or by any kind of law.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak has reportedly given the army 1 month to come up with a practical proposal for enlisting the ultra-Orthodox. This plan will be operational until the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, can vote on a new law when it reconvenes on October 15th after its summer recess. Jillian Kessler-Damore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
This week, writer Gore Vidal died at the age of 86. For more on his life and legacy, a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Gore Vidal, 1925-2012. He was ever a master writer, lucid, clear, principled, and especially in his latter years, anti-imperialist. Born in, of all places, West Point, New York, 86 years ago, Gore Vidal, a son of American aristocracy, was a traitor to his class of means and influence, but it never seemed to bother him. He wrote some of the funniest, wittiest words ever written in the language, and he spoke the same. In an interview in March of 2005 with journalist Steve Perry of the Minneapolis City Pages, Vidal gave this response to questions about Iraq and the prospects of the American empire. He said, "Well, let us say that the old American republic is well and truly dead. The institutions that we thought were eternal proved not to be. And that goes for the three departments of government. And it also goes for the Bill of Rights. So we're in uncharted territory. We're governed by public relations. Very little information gets to the public, thanks to the corruption and or ineptitude of the media." Those are the words of the late and remarkable Gore Vidal, a writer, bon vivant, a really interesting dude. Gore Vidal, 86, joins his ancestors. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Molly Stentz and Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.
Thank you to FSRN for the stories and headlines. More can be found on their website at fsrn.org. And that's our show for this Friday. Thank you for listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. If you'd like to get involved or volunteer or give us a hot news tip, please feel free to send us an email at news@citr.ca. Please join us on Monday for another edition of News 101. I'm Claire Eagle, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Stranded.